From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, what you need to know about a new law that bans cell phone use while driving or cycling.
Holding a cell phone goes against the idea that you can hold a phone, have a conversation, use the features associated with modern technology, and not be distracted.
Also today, a new documentary shows how the Bard Prison Initiative gives prisoners a second chance and a college degree.
Most of my experiences came from prison work. It was the bachelor's degree from BPI that gave me the opportunity to go into the interview and to prove myself.
And at the end of the hour, we will take your calls on how to make the perfect Thanksgiving pie.
Pie making isn't the easiest thing to do, which makes me wonder who came up with the saying it's as easy as pie. But to me, anything that gets you in the kitchen baking is a good thing.
That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. This Thanksgiving is set for the second highest travel volume in almost 20 years. AAA estimates nearly 50 million people will hit the roads. For Massachusetts drivers, it's a good time to practice putting down the cell phone. Governor Baker signed a bill into law yesterday banning any use of handheld devices, such as cell phones, while driving or cycling. Here's Governor Baker as he was signing the bill.
When a driver on an electronic device hits something or someone, that's not an accident. It's a crash that was avoidable.
So there you go, drivers and cyclists. No texting, no scrolling, no swiping. Enforcement doesn't go into effect until February, but we wanted to take some time today to talk about what this is going to mean for people on the roads. So joining us on the line is Massachusetts State Representative and Assistant Majority Leader Joseph Wagner, who's been filing legislation on distracted driving since 2003. Welcome, Representative.
Hi, how are you?
Well, and you?
Very well, thank you.
Good. Also joining us is Chelsea Police Chief Brian Kies. Chief Kies, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
All right. So I'm going to start with you, Representative Wagner. Could you please explain what the law allows and prohibits when it comes to cell phone use while operating a car or a cycle?
Sure. Well, if I could, let me pick up on the point that it has that the law doesn't take effect for 90 days or until February. Primary enforcement can happen even in the interim period until then, but with only warnings given, and that's actually from this point until March 31st. And the ban on texting is still in place, so I don't want to go too far afield here, but law enforcement can still stop motorists who are texting, and that is primary.
And let me just pause for a second there and check.
Sure.
Chief Kies, are you planning to begin enforcement immediately?
Well, As Rep. Wagner just indicated, so there has been a law in the books since 2010 that prohibits texting and driving, which, you know, police departments have been involved in enforcing that. I think that certainly at this point, as a matter of fact, it's actually, you know, great that Rep. Wagner just actually made that point. I was under the impression that we really weren't going to get into the hands-free provision until the 90-day run. And then thereafter, certainly with the warning period to the end of March and probably beyond that as well. But that's good information.
Well, and you know, perhaps I should double check on that because there is a 90-day, but perhaps it's the interim period, Chief, between the 90 days and March 31st.
So I
hope I didn't misspeak on that. I'll check and get a clarification. In any event,
okay.
Until March 31st, at a point at which law enforcement would begin to enforce, it would only be warnings, and then upon implementation on March 31st, the provisions under the law for $100 first offense, $250 second offense, and $500 per third and subsequent offenses, with those third and subsequent being surchargeable.
Representative Wagner, I can imagine listeners going, but wait, how do I not offend? So what is it physically won't be able to do?
Put down the phone. The law, with respect to the hands-free provisions, very simply, provides that operators of motor vehicles cannot hold electronic mobile devices while driving. It's as simple as that.
Okay, so
and,
Sorry. Go ahead.
You can use your phone to receive and make phone calls. If your car is in Bluetooth mode, but you cannot pick up the phone, you cannot dial a number with the phone, you cannot text. If the phone or a built-in device is attached to the dash, and you can use one swipe to activate the phone, that is an acceptable thing. But put down the phone. It's as simple as that.
So hands-free Bluetooth. I don't want to run down the rabbit hole of tons of scenarios, but you're operating your GPS. A call comes in. Are you allowed to touch the phone to reject the call so you can continue to see the GPS screen? That kind of thing?
You can't. You could activate or deactivate a call with a swipe.
Okay.
And that's it. Other than that, you're not to touch the phone under the law.
So one of the questions that came up as we were preparing for this segment is, you know, this is really about distracted driving. The focus here is cell phones. But what about changing the song track or the radio station, putting on lipstick, eating a French fry? How far does this law go? Is it exclusively focused on devices?
Well, and the chief would know this as well, but we already have a distracted driving provision in Mass General Laws in Chapter 90. So, you know, law enforcement can enforce for matters of distracted driving at present.
And what kind of things do you look for, Chief Kies?
Well, as was everything you just indicated. I mean, certainly if someone is, they're brushing their hair, they're putting on makeup and drinking coffee at the same time while they're operating a motor vehicle and they're drifting all over the road, I mean, that is certainly an issue that we would address. But certainly this is something different that we've seen. It's at a whole nother level, I think, when it comes to cell phone use and how people are being distracted. And not so much, I mean, I'm glad the law reads the way it does. I think it's a very comprehensive piece of legislation. I think that the idea of people staring at their phone, looking down at a text or an email, and then just veering off the road even for a second is really what's been, you know, the problem that we've seen certainly since over the last several years.
And Representative Wagner, it occurs to me I should ask you to clarify, what about emergency cell phone use in a vehicle?
Yes, there are provisions, let me see if I can find it here. I've got the law right in front of me. I'll look for it. But there are provisions where if it's an emergency, there are very limited exceptions for that type of thing.
And my understanding is, you know, like an emergency 911 call is okay, or if you're pulled over and not on the side of the road and not moving in the vehicle.
Yes, if you're pulled over and on the side of the road and the vehicle isn't traveling, that would, I believe, is within the law.
Chief Kies, this sounds like it could be complicated to enforce. Do you anticipate that it will be so?
Well, I mean, honestly, I think the 2010 law was complicated to enforce.
That's
the texting law? Yeah, I think only because, you know, individuals did have a justification for using the phone. They would claim that they were looking at the GPS. They would claim that they were just answering the phone or just dialing a number. And oftentimes, perhaps they were, but distracted nonetheless. I think that this one here, as Rep. Wagner just indicated, put down the phone. They can't be using the phone. The electronic device no longer can be utilized in their hands. So it does make enforcement a lot easier. I don't think police officers per se are driving around going to be staring inside every single motor vehicle. But again, what usually jumps out at us is the driving behavior. Someone's driving down the street, and we see it all the time where there's the stop at a light. The light turns green, and the individual that's first in line is just sitting there because they're looking at their phone. Someone's driving down the street, and God forbid they start to veer over the double yellow line in the wrong side of the road. And again, they could be reading a text, or God forbid they're sitting there trying to drive and type at the same time. So these are the enforcement activities that we would intervene with. And in doing so, looking down to see if they are actually using the phone, that they would be subjected to the fines, as the rep indicated, the 100, the 250, and the 500. But again, we would hope that we can get the message out there collectively through education, that we can really work together as a strong group to kind of change the social norm and really just change the culture. We're all so used to it, I think, a lot of us, for so many years, that this is going to be a significant change. But in the long run, it's really going to increase public safety on our roadways.
You know, go ahead, Chief.
If I may, I just want to make three very quick points to what the chief said, and I agree with every word of it. First, in 2010, I was chairing the Committee on Transportation, and the House, in a bill that went to conference, had a hands-free provision. And at that time, there weren't the votes in the Senate to move it forward, and it was laid aside in conference committee. And I made the argument that we could not, that law enforcement would not be able to sufficiently enforce the ban on texting, which was in the bill in conference committee, if people could still hold cell phones. And so the chief's absolutely 100% correct on that. Number two, with respect to the education piece, there are provisions in the bill for the Executive Office of Public Safety, together with the Safety Division of MassDOT, together with local chiefs. There will be a campaign around education for junior operators and adult drivers, and that is to occur on an annual basis. And I know the chief will be way ahead of the curve on that one, and so will his colleagues across the Commonwealth. Third, I live about 10 minutes from the Connecticut border, and every other New England state has a ban on handheld phones. And when I drive over the line into Connecticut, you just don't see people on cell phones. So the chief's right there as well. It's an attitudinal type of change. It's going to take some time. We will have a ramp-up period, but the roads are going to be a lot safer, and there will be many, many fewer lives lost to distracted driving.
I want to talk about a controversial piece of this law. One important part, and a lot of the negotiating around it over the past couple of years, has been concerns over racial profiling and enforcement of the law. Some are worried that the ban will give law enforcement an excuse to pull over people, and that will excessively affect people of color who are already disproportionately targeted in traffic stops. The law does require police officers to collect racial data on each stop they make, whether results in a citation, a warning, or an arrest, in order to track what groups of drivers this is happening to. Some don't think that goes far enough. Here's Shigun Itawu. He's executive director of the Black Economic Council of Massachusetts, co-founder of the Boston Police Camera Action Team. And he worked with State Representative China Tyler on the bill. She was the only opposing vote in the House.
Adding more reasons to the slate for pulling people over means that eventually that folks of color will be the most impacted by this. Unfortunately, we're taking baby steps. So, you know, yes, it is helpful, but, you know, we want to take one full swing at this thing, not spend the next 20 years pushing for something that should have been done when we were pushing for it.
Chief Kais, do you share that concern, and what can law enforcement do about it?
Well, I mean, you know, you mentioned about disparate treatment or that disproportionality in terms of targeting a specific race. You know, honestly, I can understand the argument. I can understand the premise of it anecdotally. I'm just having
actually, there's a lot of good data to show that it does happen, at least across nationally.
So we're talking Massachusetts. So in Massachusetts, I would love to see the data. I mean, I've been asking for it for a long time. I would love to see the data within the state of Massachusetts. Matter of fact, I would love to see a series or even an individual high profile incident where something like this occurred. That would show that, you know, a particular police department or a particular police officer was engaged in some type of racial profiling. Because I know that we have mechanisms in place across the entire state where this type of behavior is not to be tolerated under any circumstances. There'd be a serious investigation, very comprehensive investigation, and there'd be serious consequences. So I'm not blind to the fact that I see, you know, things that have been happening certainly around the country. I think we do a great job in our state. Making sure that something like this, that these type of incidents don't happen. But I understand, again, the premise of the argument, but as far as someone coming out and stating that now law enforcement is going to have a tool or a reason to profile, I think, honestly, is very insulting.
So, Chief, the law requires data tracking, which then will be observable. We'll be able to see who is getting pulled over, who's receiving warrants. If it does show bias, how does a department or a law enforcement community respond to or correct for that bias?
So,
Sure, Representative Wagner, go ahead.
Because there is a provision in the law the governor signed yesterday that says if analysis of the data would appear to indicate that there could be, even if it would be implicit, any type of profiling, that the Secretary of the Executive Office of Public Safety, in consultation with the Attorney General, could make that determination. And then in a community where that might be the case, all stops would be subject to recording rather than just those under the law and across Chapter 90 where the data is kept and accumulated and then analyzed and put out there in an aggregated fashion.
Representative, I'm so sorry. I'd like to do more on this, but I'm going to have to stop you there. We're running out of time. Hopefully, we'll have a chance to talk about this again. That's Massachusetts State Representative Joseph Wagner. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Also, Chelsea Police Chief Brian Kies, thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. What happens when we provide people who are incarcerated with a college education? That's the focus of a new documentary, College Behind Bars, which takes a look at the Bard Prison Initiative, a program of Bard College. We're going to hear from the filmmaker and an alumnus of the program, but first we wanted to talk about it with someone who has used his platform as a professional football player to shine light on criminal justice reform, Patriot safety Devin McCourty, who's also a governing member of the NFL Players Coalition, an athlete-led organization that advocates for racial and social justice. We talked with Devin about how the film relates to his work off the field, and he started by telling us his reaction to the film.
I was blown away, I think, by the individuals that took part in the program. Not only just took part in it, but excelled. And we watch a little bit of a young man saying he would study around 2, 3 a.m. because that's when he felt like he was his best. You know, when everyone else was sleeping, you know, he would study his notes and prepare and get ready for class the next day. So I thought that was great to see them in a true human light. Just like we see the different individuals that go to school and try to become a better part of society, I think you were able to see them in that same light in this documentary.
Devin, what do you want people to take away both from this documentary and from the Bard College Program for College Education in Prison?
I think the opportunity that we give individuals, you know, we send people away to jail and prisons to be locked away and tell them they're no good to society. But when you watch this film, you see the improvements they make, you know, obviously from an education standpoint, but just as people, you know, they walk out rehabilitated and ready to make a difference. And I hope when people watch this film, they can see not just a person thrown in prison, but a person's story come to light and how they choose to make a difference, how they choose to better themselves. And I think we all can learn from that because we all go through mistakes in life and we all try to get better from them.
Devin, you joined two former NFL players lobbying for criminal justice reform at the State House back in March, and the state's actually passed a major criminal justice reform bill that included a provision that was really important to you, raising the age at which children can be criminally prosecuted. What else do you want to see from public officials on this issue?
Yeah, that was awesome to be a part of that. And I remember right when it passed, and we talked about, you know, the next step being to raise the age on the upper end. So you can get kids between 18, 19, 20 whose brains are still developing and get them under that juvenile statute so they're not tried as adults and just thrown right into the criminal justice system and now kind of become a statistic. So right when that happened, we talked about that, and now it's kind of here. It's approaching with the opportunity to raise that age. So I'll also be heavily involved in trying to get that done.
Do you see this as your responsibility, Devin?
I do, but I don't think you can put that on everyone. But I think we all have a platform in the NFL, and you should use it for something. And I think a lot of us, you know, whether our family members or friends, have gone through different circumstances at the time that we didn't think we could do anything about, we didn't think we could fix. And now I have a platform where I can try to make a difference and make a change to some of those stories that I've had to witness or hear about. So it's been very exciting and humbling to be a part of that.
That was New England Patriots safety Devin McCourty talking about his work with the NFL Players Coalition and the documentary College Behind Bars. Devin talked about a man in the documentary who's shown studying into the wee hours of the night, the only time, he says, that he could focus in prison. The student's name is Sebastian Yoon, and the two actually met shortly after our conversation at a screening of the documentary. Sebastian earned his associate's and bachelor's degrees through the Bard Prison Initiative and is currently a program specialist for Open Society Foundations. We sat down with him and Lynn Novick, who directed and co-produced College Behind Bars, with Sarah Botstein. Sebastian said he was initially skeptical about the documentary project because of how he'd seen prisoners depicted in documentaries before.
When I watched documentaries and on prison, I saw like the stereotypical image of prisoners exhibiting violent and irrational behavior, And what I imagine is that viewers would not see these individuals and say, we want these people to come back to society. Mm-hmm. They should remain in prison. However, Lynn took this very bold experiment and she said, I want to show a side of prison that most people probably never will see. And this, and that is of just human beings being warehoused in prisons. And then now education comes in and how education transformed these individuals.
Lynn, did your understanding of the prison system evolve as you did this project?
Absolutely. I mean, I think in looking back, I really didn't know that much about mass incarceration. I knew it was terrible. I knew it disproportionately affected communities of color and people in less advantaged circumstances in our society, but I'd never been inside a prison before. But I think largely what we tried to focus on in our film was what is possible and sort of what's lacking from prison among many, many things is opportunity and hope and possibility. And this program and other programs like it that offer people a chance to transform themselves and get an education and leave prison prepared to reenter society. That said, we always wanted our audience to know that this was happening inside a prison. And so over time, the Department of Corrections allowed us really unprecedented access to bring our cameras to places where people don't usually go who are not incarcerated to kind of see what it's like to be a student and be incarcerated at the same time.
Sebastian, did you have to actually apply to get into the Barred Prison Initiative?
Yeah, I had to take an entrance exam. I got in on my first try, so I was very fortunate.
Why? Why'd you apply?
I applied because, well, first, I was 21 years old, and I was having conversations with my friends who were on the outside, and they were in college. And they would talk to me about GPA and their courses while they were in the visiting room with me. And I would feel totally lost. And I would say, you know, I'm supposed to be out there going to college with you guys. And here I am sitting in prison just waiting for the day to end so that I could see the next. And this was going to be a repetitive thing until I get released 12 and a half years later.
You were incarcerated at age 16,
yes.
Right? So this was 5 years
into. This was 5 years into my thing.
So here is Max Kenner. He's the founder and executive director of BPI, and he's talking about how the inmates are treated as regular Bard students.
Mm-hmm.
When that door closes, you're at Bard College. Faculty are going to be evaluating what you do as a student exclusively. That is to say, the college has no interest in the nature of your criminal conviction, the length of your sentence, how much time you have left in prison. It's not our business. We're in the business of education. This is the thing we know how to do, and we happen to do it here.
Okay, so that was intimidating to me, just listening to him when I was watching the documentary. So your classes happened in a school setting, but the reality is that anytime you weren't in the classroom, you were in prison. And
yes.
Even when you were in the classroom,
right.
You were in prison. You didn't have the resources that a traditional school setting would have, the environment. The word that kept coming up over and over was the environment is chaos.
Right.
So what challenges did that present for you?
The biggest challenge for me was catching a ticket, whether it was something I was guilty of or not. You can be.
What does that mean, catching
so,
a ticket?
So, for example, you can have a ticket for, you can get a ticket for having over 10 books in your cell because it's a fire hazard. But throughout our courses, we could have one course that gives us 10 books. So how do we navigate this? And I had my peers who actually got tickets because they had more than 10 books in their cells.
What happens when you catch a ticket?
You can get key blocked, which is like punishment. You can't come out of your cell. And then the worst one is when you're sent to SHU, which stands for Special Housing Unit, and you're locked in for 23 hours a day for like 30, 60, 90 days.
We had a chance to talk with Patriot Safety Devin McCourty.
Mm.
And when we asked him, had he seen parts of the documentary and how did he feel about them, one of the things he specifically spoke about was being struck by a prisoner who was studying who would study at 2 or 3 in the morning when they could really focus. That was you. That was you. So how does it feel to know that your dedication to your goal, your endeavor, was inspiring not only in your context, but in a, I mean, this is an NFL player,
right.
the height of dedication to his profession.
Right.
Were you that kind of serious about your studies?
I certainly was, but what's the thing with this documentary is that you only see a handful of us. If you only met all the other BPI students, they all do the same thing. I mean, if you look at the film, you could see the dark bags under our eyes, and that's from lack of sleep, because we really work so hard, because I've said this before, but education becomes a lifeline for us, and we hold on to it with all our heart. And that's the only thing that gives us hope in a place that is hopeless.
So that raises this question of motivation, Sebastian. Mm. Where was the urgency coming from for you?
Going to prison at the age of 16 was very difficult, and I struggled to find a reason to continue to live in prison. And I spent most of my days just staring at the ceiling, thinking about what life would be like upon being released, and everything seemed so bleak and empty, and I wanted to put color into that world, and I found it through education, the professors, the books. And despite being in such a dark place where I was dehumanized, I found purpose and I found life.
Lynn, we hear, Sebastian, in your voice, the pain of those early years and the isolation. There's a lot of the prison experience that you either don't or can't tell in the documentary. What did you not tell, and why?
You know, I think in listening to Sebastian, the thing that came to mind for me that was revelatory that I didn't understand, among many things I didn't know, was the sense of the isolation and loneliness in prison. And, you know, the stereotypes are that it's violent and scary and dangerous, but actually the dehumanizing that happens from the second you're involved in the criminal justice system is magnified and magnified. And so I was very surprised to learn from the acting commissioner of Department of Corrections in New York, Anthony Annucci. He said, my biggest problem is suicide in prison. That's a huge problem. And that speaks to the lack of hope that Sebastian's referring to. So trying to represent that, I think that was really important. How do you show loneliness? How do you show alienation and disappointment and all of that? And I think, you know, that I think just trying to get that feeling across, I'm not sure we could succeed, but we definitely tried to do that in contrast to what the BPI students are experiencing.
You also juxtapose some of the other kinds of jobs that are available to inmates if they're not able to study in BPI: janitorial work, manual labor. Sebastian, did knowing what the alternatives were, both, how did it feel to be among inmates who weren't having the same opportunities that you were? And are there other ways to help inmates find hope and purpose? Mm-hmm. Or is this really that rare and exclusive an opportunity?
Well, we as soon as we become Bard College students, we become proponents of education. We change the very atmosphere of the prison in which we are staying at. You'll notice that every time the entrance exam comes around in the summertime, about 2-3 months prior, we start going to the yard and we start having discussions with others, telling them, hey, the entrance exam is coming in 3 months. Do you want to study up? And then you'll actually see inmates in the yard, both BPR students and non-BPR students, seeing and reading books and going over grammar and writing and philosophy, just having discussions.
So we do have to talk about crime. This is a college program that happens in a prison environment. Sebastian, you say in the documentary that you were incarcerated because you got into a fight and someone died. Mm-hmm. Do you ever feel tension between your crime and the fact that you got a college degree, mm-hmm. essentially as a result of
right.
that crime?
I don't want to say that I got as a result of my crime. It's just that I got it in spite of my crime. I was in a situation where I went to prison for that crime, and I took the best opportunity that I could in order to rectify the past wrongs in the best way I can.
How did your education change your understanding of where you'd come from and the reason you were in prison?
Well, education provided me the opportunity for a lot of self-reflection and kind of get over my insecurities and acknowledge my insecurities. When I was a teenager, I recognized that I wanted to feel loved and I wanted power because I felt weak. I was a victim of bullying and I went to the streets, and that's where I found power. And going to prison, I lost everything. And I was just reduced to just a shell of a human being. And education, like I said again, was the only thing that I could hold on to.
The BPI is not without controversy, especially around funding. There's a lot of debate over whether public funds should be used to provide college education to inmates, mm-hmm. Whether this benefit should even exist. Here's one subject, Peter Lopez, explaining why some don't like the idea of paying for the program.
A lot of people feel that they work damn hard to support their families, and that if anyone should get an education, it should be their children, not someone who has menaced society, has committed crimes against citizens. But they named this thing the Department of Corrections. How could you correct someone if you're taking the very tools that actually correct and rehabilitate the individuals that you want to be protected from?
Sebastian, what's your reaction to that?
Here's the economical argument. So there are over 2.1 million inmates across the United States in prison and jails. For every dollar that we spend on education today, we would save $4 to $5 every year. Let me also add the recidivism rate. Nationally, it's 67%. Within the first 5 years, for BPI students, it's less than 5%. But I think that people often overlook the economical arguments and the recidivism arguments.
One of the things that is striking about the documentary is the way that people inside the prison begin to understand their relationship with the community outside the prison. How did you set out to tell that story, or did that part tell itself?
It does become a theme of the film, and it, I think, challenges all of us to ask the same question Sebastian was saying about, you know, what is prison for? Who has access to education? And what are we as citizens demanding of our leaders who have these put these systems in place that are totally broken? But we also tell a different story now, which is we've seen change, and we built that in over time, that in 2016, the Obama administration reinstituted a small sort of experimental version of Pell Grants and made college available to 12,000 people who weren't having it before across the country. And the Trump administration is actually expanding that program. So I think we're seeing a more common sense criminal justice reform conversation and understanding that education has to be at the core of anything that's going to be meaningful.
Sebastian, you cited earlier the statistics on recidivism.
Mm-hmm.
You re-entered society.
Mm-hmm.
You're at a prestigious foundation now. What difference did your college degree make in your re-entry?
I don't think I would be in OSF right now if I did not have that degree, because, you know, it struck me when I wrote my resume and cover letter that most of my experiences came from prison work, like working in the mess hall, cooking burgers. And how could I go to OSF and say, hey, this is my resume, can you give me a job? Of course not. It was the BA, the bachelor's degree from BPI, that gave me the opportunity to go into the interview and then prove myself that I was worthy of this.
I want to talk about your father for a minute, Sebastian. You gave a speech at your commencement, and during that speech, you apologized to your dad. Here's some of that.
My dad. Papa, I'm sorry for having dishonored our family. For putting you through such undeserved and unbearable pain. 아빠, 사랑합니다. Thank you.
Your father was there. What was it like to be able to share that accomplishment with him and give him that message?
Well, having raised me by himself, that man has loved me tremendously, and I felt like by coming to prison, I've hurt the only person that really truly loved me. And that moment was for me to say, here's the beginning of my redemption. Here's my moment to become a son who can make you proud. And that was a highlight of my BPI career, to have spoken that message to my dad and to have received that degree. And my dad, from that day on, he was so happy, and he would actually brag to his buddies that my son, you know, despite being in prison, has obtained a college degree.
You also talk about, in the documentary, you talk about being on a high from graduation, but then right after the ceremony, you have this realization.
You have this big smile on your face when you're leaving the auditorium and the mess hall, and you see this room, and then all of a sudden, reality just comes crashing upon you. And then you say, oh, this is my reality. But I thought what just happened in the auditorium was also reality. So you have this problem where you have to try to juggle these two realities, one of which is so beautiful and one of which is so dark and disgusting.
What's your reality now?
My reality is I'm just looking forward. I think in prison, all we did in the prior to BPI is think about what I should have done and could have done. And after BPI, it was about what should I do in spite of my past.
Lynn, do you think about and do you worry about the BPI graduates who still have time to serve when they've completed their degrees?
I mean, That is one of the unusual aspects of this particular college program, that not every student who graduates leaves campus. And there are people who are still there, sometimes for many years and sometimes for a shorter amount of time. But I think what's wonderful is that the program gives them the opportunity to keep taking classes. You can even have a whole other major sometimes and, you know, a whole new course of study, and also sort of mentor the students coming in. And so I think it's given everybody, they would say, an opportunity to find purpose, even in a place where that's very hard to do. And luckily, I think the parole system in New York State anyway is evolving so that people are getting released when they're up for parole more often than they used to. So there's more hope for that. But it is hard, for sure, that you could graduate and still be there.
Sebastian, you're going to do events with community, but also with communities, excuse me, but also in prisons around the film. What do you hope those who are still incarcerated but will see this documentary, what do you hope they'll take away?
See that they could be in the same position as we are, who are in social reform work, that you don't have to come home and think that your ceiling is working somewhere at like Walmart. Like, that's what I used to think, that when I come home, I can't do any serious jobs. I'm not putting down anybody that works there, but there's that notion that if you come out of prison, you're going to be sweeping floors. You're going to be mopping floors. You're going to be putting stocks on the cabinets. You can do something more. You can become somebody.
And Lynn, what do you want the public to take away from watching this?
Yeah, well, I think one of the things, the themes that comes out, which is sort of what Sebastian's just alluding to, is this horrendous sense of untapped potential and the tyranny of low expectations and the just intellectual capacity that's being wasted in our society, particularly in communities of color and behind prison walls, and that we have to really rethink who has capacity, who has potential. And this program is a shining example of what can happen when people are given an opportunity to excel and expected to excel. And this film is about, certainly takes place in prison, and it's about incarceration, but it's really about the transformative power of education. And we hope that lots of people will watch it and begin to ask these kind of really important questions.
Lynn Novick, one of the filmmakers behind College Behind Bars, thanks so much for being here today.
It's a privilege. Thank you.
And Sebastian Yoon, who earned both an associate's degree and a bachelor's degree from the Barred Prison Initiative, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
The second half of College Behind Bars airs tonight on PBS. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. All right, let's talk Thanksgiving pies. Bridget Lancaster of America's Test Kitchen is here in Studio 3 with me to talk pies. Welcome, Bridget.
I'm here to talk pies and anything else.
Excellent. And listeners, she is here for you. What is your family's iconic Thanksgiving pie? Are you making it? And if you are, what questions do you have? I always have questions about the pies. What questions do you have about how to make it or make it even better? Call us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or tweet us at Radio Boston. So, Bridget, this is a big deal.
It's kind of the Super Bowl of holidays, right?
Excellent, excellent. And America's Test Kitchen has a new book out about pies.
I sure do.
The Perfect Pie, Your Ultimate Guide to Classic and Modern Pies, Tarts, Galettes, and More.
And more.
And more. Yes. It's kind of part recipe book, part step-by-step instruction, but it proves you seem to really love pie.
Yeah, I have been told that before. I really love pie. Our company loves pie. I don't know if pies went out of fashion for a little while, but I think people are really excited about bringing them back.
Do you think they went out of fashion? Is that why now it's time for a book on the art of really good pie making?
I think so, at least the standard pie, what we think of as a pie. I think we started thinking about more tarts and galettes and things like that.
What is a galette, by the way?
Well, it can be just about anything you want it to be, but it's usually a much thinner dough. Maybe it's not baked in a pan. It can be free form. A pie tends to be baked in a pie shell.
Okay.
So whether it's one crust or two crust or crumb crust or no crust, it's a pie.
So in our house, we joke that we try to have a 2-to-1 ratio between person and pie.
I love that so much.
But is pie kind of a uniquely American thing, or is it universal?
I think it's universal. Certainly the British, when they came here, they brought a lot of pie making with them. And actually, the first pies were very similar to cakes. If you think of Boston cream pie, it's actually a cake.
Interesting.
So, but it was baked in a specific dish, which was called a pie dish, and that's how we got to pies. Of course, we have a lot better fruit here in the States. We've got some, you know, apples, and you go down to Florida, California, you can get some mangoes and other things into your pie. So I think we really took pies off and made it ours.
All right. 1-800-423-8255.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to ask your questions of Bridget Lancaster. Kirsten from Marblehead, fire away. What's your question?
Hi, Bridget. This is Kirsten from Marblehead. I make an amazing apple pie every fall from a Russell Orchard, which is up in Ipswich. We pick all the apples. We put it together. We freeze it. And then we go to cook it on Thanksgiving morning. I'm never quite sure how to get it so the pie is completely cooked on the inside and nice and brown on the outside. And then when we cut it open to make sure it's not soupy and all that juice leaks everywhere and it gets sort of like all runny.
So what's your advice, Bridget?
So a couple of things. I mean, one thing that's really counterintuitive, if you pre-cook your apples, cut the apples into slices, cook them in a pan with a little bit of butter just until they start to wilt, that actually helps them set their pectin, set their shape. And pre-cooked apples tend to hold their shape better than uncooked apples in a pie plate, in a pie dish, and people don't think that. So I would pre-cook your apples. I would also, what kind of thickener are you using? Are you still on the line?
Not sure if we've still got her online.
Okay.
We don't.
That's all right. So it depends on the type of thickener. I would use flour as a thickener. She's probably using cornstarch. I would use flour. Flour can take a lot more heat. So that way she can keep it in the oven a little bit longer and it'll thicken nicely.
And temperature?
350 is always a good idea for just about any pie.
And how long in general does one cook a fruit pie at 350 degrees?
Right. So something like an apple pie. So you've got two crusts. So you've got a lot of steam in there. You're talking at least 35, 40 minutes, maybe even up to 55 minutes, depending on if it's a deep dish.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK for questions about excellent pie. Dean from Hyde Park, pull up a seat at the table. What's your question?
It's not a question. It's a comment. It's a plug for a sour cream pie crust. It might sound weird if you've never done it, and you can easily Google it. There are probably a couple different recipes for it, but it's basically flour, butter, sour cream, a little salt and sugar, no water, no vodka, or whatever people use in these many different pie crust recipes that I've seen and mostly destroyed until I came across this one. It is foolproof. It's easy. It's nice and flaky and puffy. Everyone loves it. I use it for sweet pies, savory pies, galettes, open face, whatever, and it is delicious.
Well, and I also love, Dean, that he knows what a galette is, I feel.
It's true. That's true.
So what about the sour cream in the pie crust?
Yeah, that works. We actually have a sour cream pie dough. I think what's interesting here, too, is that there is a pie dough to fit anyone. So people are afraid of making pie dough.
I'm afraid of making pie dough.
Exactly, for a really good reason, because we think that one dough has to serve everyone. But no, you find the one that works well for you. Sour cream is a high-fat product, so it's going to make a nice flaky dough. It's got a little bit of acid in it, so it's going to be a tender dough as well. It sounds like a great idea.
All right, I want to get to more calls, but before we do, I want to eat pie. And you brought a beautiful pie that represents one of the kind of really clever twists on traditional Thanksgiving pies that your book has. So tell us about the pie you bought while I take my taste.
Okay.
And then you get second taste.
So this is a pumpkin praline pie. So you think about the standards of Thanksgiving, right?
My goodness.
You have a pumpkin pie, and then you separately, you'll have a pecan pie, or depending on where you're from in the country, a pecan pie, and you might have an apple pie as well. Well, this takes two of those pies, the pecans, and it's on top in a streusel layer, and underneath is this creamy, beautiful custardy pumpkin filling.
There's heaven in there too, I'm pretty sure.
And it's rich. It's got dark brown sugar, so it's got a little bit of a molasses kind of flavor to it. It's perfect this time of year.
Yeah, you know, I'm actually not much of a pumpkin pie fan, and I'll let you take a bite.
I'm going to
then take my time going to a call so you can chew. But the extra sugar, that deep brown sugar flavor, the nuttiness on top really kind of tamps down the pumpkin. Gives it a nice combination. And it also feels like my mother's summertime pecan pie.
Aww.
With the wintertime pumpkin pie.
There you go.
It's a really nice combination.
That's brilliant, yeah.
All right, Becky from Milton, it is your turn. What's on your mind?
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. First of all, we love America's Test Kitchen. They're fabulous.
Thank you.
I have made an apple pie for my family for a long time. Always used Crisco and used to use just regular flour. My husband's gluten-free now. And we found that he can tolerate Italian flour that's directly from Italy.
Mm-hmm.
It's a Grono 00. But it breaks for me. And I'm wondering if you have any suggestions on what I should be doing.
Perfect.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So the 00 flour does not have a lot of gluten in it, and that is why your husband can tolerate it, but it's also why it is starting to break on you. So things that you can add to a gluten-free tart dough, or even in this case, even though it does have a little bit of gluten, is a little bit of xanthan gum. So xanthan gum is going to sort of act like that stretchy material that gluten forms, that elastic kind of ability.
Z-A-N-T-H-A-M.
That's correct. Okay. Actually, it's an N at the end.
Xanthan.
I think, yeah, xanthan
okay.
gum. A little bit of that, a teaspoon added to the dry ingredients before you mix your dough together. That should really help. The other thing is you want to let that dough hydrate for a while. So before, you don't want to roll it out right away. You want to put it together. You want to give it a good 30 more minutes than you would with a regular recipe, regular pie dough, to let the flour really start to hydrate, because it doesn't hydrate as quickly as a full-on gluten, full pie dough would.
And let's take another call. We've got Ruth from Acton on the line. Ruth, go ahead.
Hi, ladies. Happy holiday week to you.
You too.
I have an unrequited love relationship with pastry. As much as I love to bake, and I try to do it very often, I have a particular thing I want to bake, and the dough will not behave. I want to make mini pies this year with like an empanada kind of dough, and my dough comes out pale and hard after the oven rather than flaky and golden. What am I doing wrong?
What indeed?
Well, that's so you mean mini as in tiny, not as in many, as in a lot of pies, right?
Mini as in M-I-N-I, okay. Right, Ruth?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Well, if you think about it, so the smaller the dough, the less time something is going to be in the oven. So that's the less time that it has an opportunity to brown. So things that you can do to try to get your pie dough to brown a little bit is take a look at your ingredients. Are there any kind of acidic ingredients? Acidic ingredients will prevent foods from browning.
Why? Well, maybe that's too common. I don't know.
You know, that's a really good question. I'm not sure I have the answer to it right now, but I do know that adding a little bit of baking soda into just about anything is going to help with browning. The other thing is maybe you want to sprinkle some brown sugar on the outside, melt some butter and a little bit of brown sugar. Butter's going to help with browning because there are milk solids in there that are going to toast very quickly. So I think, or at least I hope that would help with the coloring.
And Bridget, when you say a little bit of baking soda, mm-hmm. do you mean like half a teaspoon or a pinch or?
Like quarter to a half a teaspoon max.
Okay. Okay.
You don't want to taste it in there.
Okay. So there are going to be some listeners who have not tried to make a pie mm-hmm. before. And rather than terrifying them so that they never want to, let's start with a basic recipe that you would recommend a first timer try. What's the right first time pie?
That's a really good question. I would say actually for this time of year, pumpkin pie is perfect. So pumpkin pie, let's talk about the crust first. You're going to want to blind bake the crust, and that sounds like a terrifying term.
Yes, it does.
So, and I'm going to say something that maybe people don't want to hear, but if you need to buy refrigerator ready roll out pie dough to make a pie, then you do it.
Whatever, no shame.
No shame. Whatever gets you into the kitchen and gets that pie into the oven, you get to say, you know what? And you get to say, yes, that's my pie, because guess what? You bought the dough. So you,
so I love it.
It belongs to you. So you want to fit the pie dough into the pan. Anything that's hanging over the sides, you just roll it back, do a little crimping. You can use a fork to make a nice pattern around it. And then you would blind bake it. That means you're going to put a couple layers of foil in there. And pie weights, fill it up with pie weights. If you do not have pie weights, I have a giant jar of pennies that's in my kitchen that I use and reuse and reuse for baking over and over and over again. It never touches the food because it's touching the foil instead. So you let that pie dough bake for about 15 minutes. Take the foil off. Let it go another 10 minutes. Your pie dough is basically done. And all you have to do is make the pumpkin filling. And what's good about a blind baked pie dough, you can make it the day before. So you can really, like, take it easy.
So then how do people store that crust once mm-hmm. it's been baked before they put the pumpkin pie filling in?
So you would wrap it with a little bit of plastic wrap, maybe some foil. If you want to put it in the freezer, you can store that up in the freezer for a month or two in advance. And then the pumpkin pie filling is super easy. It's just actually pumpkin puree right out of the can. You put it in the food processor with an egg, some brown sugar, your spices. It goes into a saucepan, and you cook it over low heat until it goes what I call bloop, bloop, bloop. You start to see a little bit of spluttering. pour it into your pie shell, into the oven.
All right. And our website, RadioBoston.org, has your top five tips for pies, things like pre-treat your fillings and measure your ingredients. That is America's Test Kitchen's Bridget Lancaster. Bridget, thanks. That was really fun.
Happy Thanksgiving.
You too. And I can't wait to have another bite of the pie. Find more information about The Perfect Pie, your ultimate guide to classic and modern pies, tarts, galettes, and more on our website, RadioBoston.org. That is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.